You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, welcome, welcome, welcome to the cycling podcast Feminine. The classic season is well underway, isn't it? And I know that that is my... Oh, my name is Rose Manning. I should say that right at the top. It's my favourite part of the season. I know that Denny, who, you know, we're going to introduce a little later on, it's going to be his favourite part of the season because every part of the season is Denny's favourite part of the season. But before that, we have the return of cycling writer, commentator and presenter Rebecca Charlton. Nice to have you back, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me back, Rose and Denny.
And you just said off air actually that your parents really find it annoying when people say thanks for having me back or happy to be here, and you just fallen straight into that trap. So I hope the Charlton parents aren't listening to this.
Well, let's hope they sometimes listen to some of the things we do, some of the content. But yeah, it's one of their pet hates when people go on a radio show or a podcast and say, well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. So I thought I'd just go straight in with that.
Oh, wonderful. What a great positive start. And I've come to you first, Rebecca, yes. Because Denny, we have failed. Denny Gray of the British Continental. We have failed to give you a big intro, which I did promise you. In January, I promised you, I didn't do it in February, and Rebecca has kindly stepped in and said, it's not going to happen unless I do it. So thank you, Rebecca. She's going to give you, I hope this is going to be a big and long enough intro for you, Denny. I haven't read it myself.
Wow, this is like a surprise birthday party.
Doesn't even know where this is going.
So take it away, Rebecca. Who is this man that's standing with us here?
Okay, here goes. It has been apparent over at least the last three episodes that this man needs no introduction. Instead, he has sat in while Rose Manley has kicked off proceedings with an articulate fanfare for each and every other guest, even the guy that bought us a plate of fish fingers once, eagerly awaiting a list of his own career and perhaps even lifelong accolades. But she has simply moved swiftly along. At the Cycling Writers' Christmas Do, he was set to unveil his talents as a singer-songwriter, but he was half wheeled into Lucky Voice Soho when fellow journalist George took the mic on the opening line of Park Life. To add insult to injury, I later stole a couple of his cheesy bites at Wandsworth McDonald's in what Martin McCutcheon would call the dodgy end. In his spare time, he likes to write jokes about the dominance of SD Works, but just like Lidl Trek, he no longer wants to be the bridesmaid, but it's time now to be the bride. Please welcome back to the Cycling Podcast Feminine, Denny Gray.
Wow, that was incredible. Absolutely incredible. I'm blown
I'm
away.
Dumbfounded. That was absolutely amazing. You're going to have to write one every single month, Rebecca.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me back. Yeah.
well, what do you say to that, Denny?
I am quite speechless. I think there's a career for you in doing intros, writing intros for the rest of the cycling podcast episodes. To come.
Oh, yeah, you might consider a career in presenting, actually.
Yeah, you'd be pretty good at that, I reckon.
You'd be quite good at that.
Thanks, guys.
But I did actually say, you know, Rebecca Charlton, I was so tempted after, you know, this is the Ninka Vinka crew, isn't it? We spoke on our first episode of the year back in January about the DSM Firmenich rider, Ninka Vinka, and her fantastic name. And then we were afterwards trying to, you know, play around with a few names. We came up with Rebecca Pecker for you.
Yeah, how did
Rebecca,
we get so to that, Denny? How did we reach that?
I think you felt you needed a rhyming name to make it back onto the cycling podcast.
Yes.
So
we like
we arrived at Becca Pecker.
But unfortunately, we don't have much to report on. We are the, you know, Ninka Vinka watch group, aren't we? We don't have much to report on Ninka Vinka. She was at the Tour de Normandy, and I think Josie Nelson and teammate won a stage there. But yeah, nothing else to report from Ninka. So Ninka, come on, please give us a little bit more to follow, because also thank you to Seamus on X or Twitter for giving us the earworm Inka Dinka Do, which he changed to Ninka Vinka Dinka Do, which has been, you know, played at podcast towers ever since, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But yes, we've been playing that song a lot at podcast towers. I've been playing it ever since, actually, but we're just waiting for the next big appearance from our favourite rider, Ninka Vinka. But not going to be talking about her much, but we've got plenty of other stuff to talk about in this month's episode. We've had some of the big classes. We had Strada Bianca, which feels like ancient history already, which is absolutely crazy. We've had Trofeo Binder, we had Ronde van Drenthe, those are the World Tour races that we've had. And then we've also had a number of smaller races that we've had some interesting storylines coming out. Maybe the toppling of SD Works, dare I say that. Plus, we've got our third mini feature of the year, which is about the last women back at Paris-Roubaix. So, you know, we spend so much time concentrating on the winners and the podium and how they got there. But I've taken a little delve into the riders that finished outside the time limit, who were the last ones back, who completed the race and didn't get any plaudits, and what happened and, you know, how much they enjoyed the iconic race of Paris-Roubaix, which, of course, we'll be looking forward to because we're stepping into cobbled classics season. But yes, plenty of racing to talk about before that.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here just butting into the cycling podcast Feminine. Thank you, Rose and Co, for allowing me a minute or so to talk about this episode's sponsor, which is AG1. And AG1, well, it's not, let me tell you what it isn't, first of all, shall I? It's not an energy drink, it's not a meal replacement, but what it is a powerful nutritional supplement which will give your brain, body and immune system everything it needs that you might not be able to get from eating regular food. I mean, you could get it from eating regular food, but you probably have to eat quite large quantities to get the quantity and quality of vitamins, minerals and nutrients that are in AG1. It's a powder. It mixes up into a drink. And for the past few weeks, it's become a really key part of my morning routine. It's the first thing I have in the morning. It's replaced my morning cup of tea or cup of coffee. And it feels like I get the day off to a great start. I put one scoop into the AG1 bottle, fill it up with water, give it a good shake. It's pleasant to drink, much more pleasant than my old routine, which was taking packets of vitamin tablets and multivitamins and that kind of thing. And it's just one scoop once a day with a glass of water, and your brain and body and immune system will, I think, thank you. I'm not going to say it's transformed me into Superman, but it has helped me with a few tweaks to my diet and exercise regime as the spring has arrived. I've been getting back on my bike, and I've found that the AG1 in the morning is just a better way to start the day. I don't get that kind of injection of caffeine that a coffee gives me, which then inevitably leads to a little bit of a crash. I feel like it's a much more even, balanced start to the day. So if you want to give AG1 a try, you can do so by going to drinkag1.com/cycling. That's drinkag1.com/cycling. And if you sign up now and take ownership of your health, you can get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs for when you're on the move with your first purchase. So that website again is drinkag1.com/cycling, and you can get your day off to a great start with a blend of more than 70 high quality ingredients containing vitamins, minerals and nutrients that your body will thank you for.
Well, we're actually here, I failed to mention at the beginning, at the Dynamo in Putney. We're kind of continuing our Tour de Wandsworth, aren't we, Denny? And this is a proper cyclist's haunt that we're actually in. We're in the hub of cycling culture in Putney. What an accolade.
Yeah, no, it's a great little haunt. It's a favourite for cyclists who like to go around Richmond Park, which of course is nearby, and the walls are kind of... I've got kind of cycling pictures and mementos all over, kind of old jerseys from old teams. So it's a good spot actually to watch a bit of cycling as well. They have a TV here, so yeah.
Yes, and it's not far from obviously where we three all met, which was in the McDonald's in Wandsworth Roundabout. It's not very far from that as well. I do keep meaning to make a little map of all our haunts, and by the next episode, I will have actually done that. Basically, say great place to watch. Bike racing, of course, and yeah, what great bike racing we've actually had to watch. Particularly, I have to say right at the top, that win for Elisa Balsamo at Trofeo Binder. Huge win for her, coming off of a bit of a sort of quiet spell and injury, and to come out with a win at a massive race, like that World Tour race, that's actually a really, really hard race. I think it doesn't get as much publicity because it's not tied to a men's race. It probably doesn't have the sort of doesn't therefore get to take the history of the men's race, and it comes straight after Milano San Remo. But it's really difficult, really bumpy, and with Elisa Balsamo beating Lotta Kopecky in the sprint to the line there, that's, Denny, great for her, also great for Leeds Trek, though.
Yeah, it was a brilliant victory for Balsamo. Of course, she has won that race before, 2022, but I think this year felt like a step up, partly because she had such a horrendous year last year with her crash at the Ride London, where she kind of had multiple fractures and had to have surgery. She only came back, I guess, to proper form in September last year when she won a stage at the CIMAC Tour. But I think what was particularly impressive, as you said, Rose, about her win was not only the teamwork of Lidl Trek, but also the field she was up against. She was up against Lotta Kopecky, the world champion, who was probably the race favourite, and a strong SD Works team. And she rode it brilliantly. There was she kind of made it up the climbs, just about clung on with the support of her teammates, and timed her, even though she was slightly blocked in that sprint at the end, boxed in, she timed it perfectly, came around Kopecky with a, you know, and had, well, a couple of bike lengths to spare, I think, by the time she crossed the line. So it was a very, very impressive victory, and that's three wins in eight races for her so far this year, so it bodes really well for her in the upcoming classics.
And it's actually huge, isn't it, Becca? I mean, you mentioned there, Denny, that she has won Binder before. In many ways, that's actually a fantastic thing to win again, because then it kind of shows you that you are on that same form. You know, I guess taking wins and things like Valenciano is great, and they have a great field there, but it's not the same as a World Tour Neville race, is it? So to win again a race that she won when she was at the peak of her powers is a really good sign for her.
Yeah, a really good sign, and you're absolutely right there in terms of making that comparison. And you could see in the post-race interview, I think, what a big deal it was. I think we're so used to seeing riders say, like, yeah, you know, oh, I'm a little bit surprised to win. But actually, you could really feel that, I think, that was a really big deal for her to have that confirmation of her form. And I think, obviously, you mentioned how tough it was for her to come back from that crash at Ride London. And I was working on the race last year and staying at the sort of same team hotels, and Lidl Trek were in the same hotel as me in the aftermath of having that crash. And I think, you know, it probably, for anyone on the outside, people probably didn't appreciate just quite how bad that was and what a journey back it was. So I think for her to be in this form is amazing. But I kind of wanted to touch upon that sprint, actually, because I think when you're looking at the foreshortened camera view, I was having a moment where I thought, oh, Kopecky looks like she's going to get this. And then I actually, as I always do, went back and watched that sprint a couple of times from different angles and actually saw that she, yeah, slightly boxed in, completely laid off the power, sort of just sat on the pedals for a minute and then re-accelerated, moved, repositioned, re-accelerated, and then, yeah, had a bike length at least to spare at the end. So I think actually in hindsight, looking at that sprint, it looked close at the time, but she knew, I think, right, I've got a minute to actually consider where I want to be positioned here and then go again. And I thought that was really impressive.
It's also, you can't see it on the television really, because it does look kind of like a flat run-in. But it's actually like a ramp all the way to the finish line. So it's a lot more tricky. And it's also one of those things where you would think that would put it even more in Lotta Kopecky's favour and less in Balsamo's favour. So I think that's an even more amazing, makes it an even more amazing feat to have won that race. But a lot of that came down to her being in the final at all. And a lot of that was due to the work of Lidl Trek. And I know we got into a bit of a heated argument last month when I criticised their Omloop tactics and Orla was not having any of it. But, yeah, Denny, what made the difference for them this time to actually get the win?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a great team effort. I think they had a game plan going into that race, which was to ride for Balsamo. And they played it beautifully. I think, I know Gaia Raiolini and Amanda Spratt, both played really important roles in terms of positioning Balsamo, keeping her in touch on the climbs. But I think Shirin van Anroy was kind of the most valuable player in that regard, because she was covering all of the moves, all the major moves on the climbs, following them. And then at the end, there was that attack from Mariah Mayering, which looked, from the Movistar team, which looked really dangerous. And van Anroy turned herself inside out to bring that back, despite having already worked so hard during the race.
And also being the defending champion, there. It would be so easy for Little Trek to be like, oh, you know, Sheeran Van Anroy, you won it last year, so it's your race to win again. But obviously they didn't want to do that. They were kind of being canny about who they kept and whose powder they kept dry and who they didn't. And obviously
it could have paid off for Van Anroy, of course, if she followed a move which went away.
But when you're going against like Lotta Kopecky, you know, unless he works team with Marlon Reusser in it and Lotta Kopecky and Mia Fisher-Black, they clearly saw that and thought, if we can get Balsamo to the finish, then that's going to give us the best chance of winning.
I think they've been listening to you from the last episode.
Is that what you think you're
when you said that Longo Borghini and Van Anroy should have held back and ridden for Balsamo.
Well, that's kind of what I took from it as being what was key to Lidl Trek doing so well at Binder, was that, you know, yes, they were kind of attacking and watching moves, but, you know, they had been doing that all year really well, really effectively, but not necessarily getting the win. For me, it was that they were a bit more canny about who they wanted to be the rider in the final run-in. Like, as you said, Denny, like in Omloop, you know, they had Sheeran Van Anroy and Elisa Longo Borghini going against such fast finishers in Marianne Vos and Lotta Kopecky, and it's kind of a flat run-in in Omloop. And so they were kind of powerless. They couldn't really ever make an attack that wouldn't be chased down by Vos and Kopecky, and, you know, they were always going to be out-sprinted. So I think what was so vital to Lidl Trek actually winning was that they were riding for Balsamo, and because they knew that if they had one rider that was going to beat Kopecky in that finish, it was going to be Balsamo.
Yeah, and I think that's where they got it absolutely right, didn't they? You know, they played it so well throughout the entire race and then finished it off to perfection. But I think it's so often the case that you kind of look at the rider with a number one on their back and you just make that assumption, even just looking on or commentating, that, well, surely the team's going to look at prioritising that person defending that title. But I think, yeah, it was a brave move and, you know, ultimately paid off to prioritise Balsamo in the form she's in.
And Becca, what did you think about SD Works at that race? Because obviously they kind of seemed to be not doing their normal SD Works sort of tactics. They were much more like any other regular team where they were actually chasing down moves, whereas normally they kind of try and play everyone's bluff and they just sit back even though they're the strongest team there.
Yeah, I think they've been listening to you as well, Rose. Just completely.
Very harmonious. Not necessarily the most interesting of everyone to just agree with my wonderful, excellent opinions.
Look, I'm only allowed back if I agree with you. Yeah, I've signed a piece of paper. So yeah, fabulous insight, Rose. No, yeah, I think it's interesting, but I think we're also still at that point in the season, yeah, where, I don't know, we're kind of just seeing what's unfolding and what's happening. And it was a different dynamic to the race, and I think that makes it pretty exciting for what's coming up next.
Also, you know, might it be fair to say SD Works might not be at the top of their powers right now? Denny, we're aware that we're actually recording on the day of Depana, so we can't say what happens there, but we... Go on, Denny, I'm lining you up here for your joke now.
Take it away, Denny.
I should explain to the listeners, I made a joke on our WhatsApp group saying I predict that SD Works won't win Depana after, of course, the news that they won't be riding because they feel that they don't have enough riders to field a full team, given their injuries and other riders being away on altitude training. But yes, now you've teed me up for that joke. I'm not sure it's going to make the listeners roll about on the floor.
No, it's not. But I mean, should we take more from that? Obviously, they're not doing Depana because of their injuries. Because, you know, Lorena Vivas and Chantal van der Poel-Slack came down in Nocera Corsa, and although Vivas actually finished and came second, they're obviously injuries sustained, meaning they're not going to be fully able to compete at Depana. But does that mean perhaps their SD Works also a little bit thinner than they used to? I mean, it happens to a lot of teams. I mean, Lidl Trek last year, a lot of the classics that they were doing, they were turning up with, you know, four or five riders and trying to compete there. But, yeah, does that mean that maybe SD Works are a little bit at their limit and perhaps we're not seeing their strongest side been put out yet?
Yeah, and of course there's no compulsion to ride Women's World Tour events. So they don't need to be there, but you would expect them to be there and to be one of the favourites as usual. So it does feel a bit unusual. I mean, whether they're stretched or not, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just a reflection of where we are with women's racing more generally, where the calendar's getting busier and busier. Teams, squads haven't necessarily got larger. I think they've got 16 in their squad this year, which is not the smallest by any means. But of course, when you've got a whole squad training in altitude, I can see that they might feel they're a bit stretched, a bit thin. And I think maybe we shouldn't criticise them, because I think I'd rather see riders get back to full health and be able to ride effectively in the races they want to race in. So it's interesting. I think it's that point in the growth of women's cycling where I think, you know, they might want to look again at their squad size. Lidl Trek have got 19 this year, having suffered so badly with injuries last year and missing out on races. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's something they'll reflect on. But
it's also a point of privilege, though, for them, though, isn't it, that they don't need the points.
Well, that's true.
You know, that they will make up enough points winning other races and doing so well elsewhere, whereas other teams would feel like they had to turn up because otherwise they wouldn't get the points there. But yeah, it's kind of actually ominous in a way for me, because they do actually have enough riders to field a squad at Dapana, but half of them are on altitude camp, getting ready for the, including Demi Vollering, getting ready for future races to come, which for me is kind of like a bit of a scary side, really, that they might actually be even bigger and better and stronger in the future races.
Yeah, this is just a random nugget from me, but I was commentating on Omloop and went through the race, and then actually realised in hindsight again that Vollering hadn't taken her arm or leg warmers off, you know. It just gives a little bit of context, doesn't it? And now going to altitude, and then after sort of reacclimatising and benefiting from that, I mean, I think we're going to see some pretty exciting things from her and the rest of the team. But yeah, it's an interesting one, but they just want to dominate, don't they, you know?
We've seen Lidl Trek come back really strong this year, and also the return of Ellen van Dijk, which I kind of signposted a huge amount in our last episode, you know, when we did the feature about motherhood. She just come back from maternity leave. So she had her baby in October. So that's, you know, 5 months since having a baby and coming back. And, you know, like we heard in the last episode, Lizzie Dynan saying, be warned, Ellen van Dijk is really, really strong. And so she has proved. She's won, you know, when she came back, she's won 2 time trials since. And she was, you know, fighting for GC wins in both of those races.
It's just phenomenal, isn't it? I was going to say I can't get my head around it, but I can with her. And I think it wasn't just Lizzie, was it, who said how hard she was able to train through the pregnancy. And I think something for me as very, very much an amateur rider, I rode through pregnancy till 40 weeks. I know you rode your bike, Rose. And the biggest thing I'd say is everybody is so different, even if you are a professional rider. And I think that's what a lot of riders have marvelled at, is that she was able to train and she felt great on it. So I think that's a sign of what's to come from her.
But, you know, with the Lidl Trek, missed her, haven't they? That they actually really need. She's probably actually their most pivotal rider, because she, you know, might not get, I don't know, she gets lots of time trial wins, as we've seen her getting a win at the Vuelta Extremadura Feminas, which is not a big race, but, you know, she won that by about 24 seconds, but, you know, against some top riders, and then winning again in the Tour de Normandy and winning that by 20 seconds when everyone else was kind of separated, the rest of the top 10 separated by kind of 5-second intervals. Obviously, the results that she gets speak for themselves, but what she can bring to Lidl Trek now that they are finding their form is something to be very excited about.
Yeah, I mean, we've said that Lidl Trek missed her last year because she plays that Marlon Reusser role so well. She can be a great foil to her teammates. She, as you said, she can win in her own right, but also she can be that rider that brings back the escape to set up Balsamo or another teammate. So she's such a valuable rider. And not just that, I think Lidl Trek are benefiting from the return of a number of riders this year. All their riders seem on top form at the moment. We mentioned Longo Borghini earlier. We haven't talked about her great performance in Strada Bianchi yet, but they just have such strength in depth, and arguably as strong on paper as SD Works now. I mean, I think I was looking at who's been on the podium in the 4 one-day World Tour races we've had so far. SD Works have had 5 podiums, Lidl Trek have had 4. 2 wins for SD Works, 1 win for Lidl Trek. But beyond that, only Visma and Fenix have been on the podium. So really, those two teams are... Well, Lidl Trek now feel like they are a kind of level pegging with SD Works almost. You know, they have that they're being the rival that we've always wanted them to be. So that bodes well, I think, for the future races in the classics.
Which is funny, isn't it? Because we made so much of Canyon-SRAM, you know, the beginning of the year about them, you know, with Elise Chabet, and, you know, they've got a lot of young talent, and Kashanivia Doma, that they might be the big contenders in the classic season. We haven't seen that yet. Kashanivia Doma, obviously, so close to a podium at Strade Bianche, kind of heartbreakingly close. Just to remind everyone about Strade Bianche, we had Elisa Longo-Borghini and Lotta Kopecky were the duo out in front. Then they had Vollering and Nivia Doma behind. And obviously, a little bit of a kind of SD Works stranglehold situation where Elisa Longo-Borghini is doing a lot of the work at the front and basically dragging Lotta Kopecky to the line, who obviously got the win in the end. And then kind of heartbreak for Kashanivia Doma to lose out to Demi Vollering for third place.
It was just, for me, it was just painful to just, I felt like I was just living through it with Kashanivia Doma, because what do you do? It's like, you know, I like to sit in my comfy chair and say, you know, how the tactics could have played out differently. But Nivia Doma, yeah, she was stuck in that position with Vollering, you know, actually Vollering did come through, but, you know, at that point it was over for her getting the position she wanted. And I think that Nivia Doma just, as usual, she just heart on sleeve, she just rode so passionately, made that big split on the Tolfe, and there were 5 riders, but unfortunately you had all the potential race winners in that 5, and then she was, just as a reminder, she was on the wheel of Demi Vollering, closely following her, and then that's when Kopecky and Longo-Borghini got away, wasn't it? And I, as I say, I just felt the pain in that moment, because as the gravel world champion, it was like, I can imagine ramping up to that, like, this is my race, this is, if everything's gonna go right on one day, it's potentially gonna be today. And you could just see the heartbreak at that moment when she knew the wrong rider from SD Works had gone, and that was probably the podium gone.
And it was such a, like, a almost like a photo finish, wasn't it, for that third place that Demi Vollering stole from her. But then, it's such a... Well, that's just testament, though, isn't it, to, like, an SD Works stranglehold. I mean, we've spoken a lot about Lidl Trek, you know, managing to, play SD Works the same game. But when SD Works, you know, get the right riders in the right position, it leaves all the other riders just without anything to do. I mean, what could Elisa Longo-Borghini have done... knowing that she was against Lotta Kopecky, extremely fast, both uphill and in the sprint, which is at the very, very end of Strade Bianche, and then with Demi Vollering behind, who's just like, you know, was the most phenomenal rider of last year. So it was kind of watching it, thinking, there's nothing Elisa Longo-Borghini can do here, there's nothing that Kashanivia Doma can do here.
Yeah, I mean,
looking at Denny.
You
that
are looking
at
me.
Gave you the little pin prod.
Yeah,
because I know that Denny's going to.
Well, we were talking off air, and I was wondering whether Longo-Borghini did the right thing in effectively pulling Kopecky to the final climb up to the Piazza del Campo, because she was essentially handing the win to Kopecky on a plate, and we were pondering what would have happened if she hadn't done that, if she said to Kopecky, come on, do a turn, if not, I'm not working with you. Well, then Vollering and Nivia Doma would have caught up with them. Of course, that would have meant that Longo-Borghini might have come away with just the 4th. But she was then giving herself more of a chance of winning, I think. It felt like she'd settled for 2nd place. She felt like that was the best she was going to get. And that may be harsh, but I felt like...
I don't know, but against Vollering and Kopecky, all likelihood would have been that she would have finished 3rd, I guess. You know, best result would have been finishing 3rd if she had not pedalled, because Kopecky wouldn't have pedalled, right? So Lisa Longo-Borghini wouldn't have pedalled, Kopecky wouldn't have pedalled, then they would have all come back as a 4. And then maybe Becca could have had her moment with Cashanida Dover winning.
It would have been a gamble, but I think it was a contrast to what happened in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, where they were, Needle Trek were just rolling the dice.
Yes,
and
that's true, yeah.
It was a much more controlled performance by Longo Borghini, and I felt like she felt like, well, I want to guarantee at least second place. And, you know, with the chances are, she would lose out to Capecchi, having done the work to pull her to the bottom of the climb.
Yeah, and I think she knew, didn't she? I do agree that she knew, right, well, because it wasn't just that she did a long turn. She absolutely led
her
all
like
the way to 500 metres.
She didn't flick an elbow out or look behind.
No, she
wasn't
like,
expecting.
Was into it. Like, this is going to be it. And then, like you say, you know, I'm going to have to settle for second here unless something else, you know, miraculously happens in the last 500 metres to the line. But I think that's the problem, isn't it? And I know we we have this topic, you know, again and again. But when you are in that position, what else can you do? Just wait for Vollering? Well, okay, well then Vollering go. You know what? What can you do when you've got two of the best, fastest riders in the world, having those two cards to play? It is impossible. But I think, perhaps you could have encouraged, tried to force her through a little bit. But ultimately, I think she knew that's. You know, that's a 1-2 right there.
Well, do we see any threats? Because we've spoken so much about Lidl Trek, we've spoken so much about SD Worlds, but do we see any threats, and touched on Canyon SRAM, obviously, but do we see any threats from anyone else, any other teams, any other people?
In the classics?
Just I guess for the rest of the season almost, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the classics, I think I'm looking forward to seeing Marianne Vos in races like Flanders, and because she looked so strong at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, obviously won the race, but not only that, the way she matched Capecchi on the climbs and was so composed.
Also at Strada Bianchi, she was following everyone in the Tolfe, which would really not be her terrain.
So she hasn't raced since Strada Bianchi, so she'll be coming back, and I think she could offer a threat. As you mentioned, Canyon SRAM, I mean, I think they... I mean, obviously, Nivea Doma will continue to be Nivea Doma and be up there. I think it's probably fair to say the rest of the team haven't got the results they might have hoped for so far, but I know that Chloe Dygert is coming back to racing, so I think that will add a really strong option for them.
I guess she's... I know you said Ellen van Dijk is like Marlon Royce. You know, Marlon Royce is that for SD Works, so Ellen van Dijk is... that role for Lidl Trek, but Chloe Dyger is actually that role for Canyon SRAM, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, before the Tour de France Femme last year, people were touting her as a potential winner for that race. Such was her form. So, she could be a real threat herself, but I guess we don't quite know what form she's going to be in. I know she had a delayed start to the season because of some complications over the winter. So, we'll see what happens, but I think that will only strengthen that team. So, but beyond that, it's difficult to see who is going to be up there for big results. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think Puk Pieterses. We know that she isn't going to do a full road racing season this season, but she is going to ride Gent Wevelgem and Dwars Dwar Vlaanderen at least before she goes back to mountain biking, and she's aiming for Olympic success later on.
Well, I'm glad you've reminded me of that before I was about to delve into Puk Pieterses being that challenger. And so let's just quick, we'll cut that bit out, we'll shift back and reflect on the season she's had so far on the road. But no, I've been really impressed about Pieterses on the road, and I've just loved like really focusing in and watching her dynamic and her communication. She's like, come on you lot, isn't she? She's like constantly telling people like, come on, elbow flick, come through,
so such a young rider as well, and not like, you know, Danny Tatch, but not a road racer, so you know, mountain biking is totally different in terms of dynamic and peloton dynamic. So it's amazing for her to just come in with so much confidence.
Yeah, so confident. And I think that's it, isn't it? She's come over to the road discipline and she's just not holding back in that respect. She's just really trying to get people organised. And you could just see the frustration where she was just like, oh, come on, somebody work with me here. And I just kind of enjoyed what she brought and that confidence she brought. Such a young rider and so versatile. And I think, again, you forget that she's not predominantly done road because she's that good. She's that good.
And also past such a, I mean, we were massive, all of, I mean, you were on our podcast at the Tour de France Femme last year, Rebecca, but we saw you plenty in the evening simply. And, you know, we were all such massive fans about Fenix de Koning as a team, kind of as a, coming in and just being, and not kind of adhering to the, oh, let the, you know, doing what the big teams want you to do, you know, mentioning that stranglehold that FC Works can put on a race. They kind of just don't agree with that and don't follow those rules. And, you know, they seem to just be so kind of in line with each other in terms of like making attacking moves and knowing what to do and how to play it. So, yeah, we look forward to watching more of them. Did want to give a quick mention to Marai Mayering, the Morrisser rider, who we saw at Binder. We did mention her a bit earlier on, making one of the final attacks at the Trofeo Binder. She's actually in her first year as a pro. She's 29 years old, lecturer at University of Utrecht in macroeconomics. And, you know, she's only just taken a pause on the lecturing last September to come in and ride for Movistar. And she's been absolutely phenomenal. She's already won the Vuelta Extremadura Feminas and was ninth on Jebel Lafitte at the UAE Tour. She's a climber, so I really look forward to it. We might not see too much of her in the rest of the classics season, but that'll be really important for Movistar to have. They have so many kind of classics riders, but they do need a climber, don't they?
They do. It's unbelievable, though, isn't it, to actually confirm all of that? Because, yeah, I was looking at the fact that it was her first year, you know, in these ranks. But actually, you filled me in on everything else she's been multitasking with. And you just think, if you're able to perform like that now, when it hasn't had perhaps your absolute full attention, or couldn't have had, could it, with all that going on, what's next for that rider? And for the team as well, of course, you know, they had a gaping hole, and the dynamic is changing within that team, which is exciting.
No, it's a great story, and I love the fact that we still get stories like that, of kind of riders coming into the sport late and performing at the highest level. I was talking to Monica Greenwood the other day. She was, of course, coached Laura Kenny, who we'll talk about later, to Olympic gold, kind of went out on a high in her coaching career, and then she's now joined Team Co-op Repsol. Having had a great season last season, her first first year as a full-time cyclist, so at the age of 33. So it's great to see kind of riders coming in kind of later into the sport and still succeeding.
Now it's time for our next mini feature. This time it's about the last women back at Paris-Roubaix. So, you know, we talk so much about the riders at the front of the race and going for the win. And I thought it was time to focus on the riders right at the very back, finishing out of the time limit, might be half an hour down, but still completing one of the hardest and most iconic races of the year.
The sound of the cobbles is unmistakable. So too is the roar of the fans as the victor raises the Pavé trophy above her head. The sights and sounds of Paris-Roubaix are etched into our minds. But what of the untold stories? What of the riders who fought their way to the velodrome long after the confetti had settled? I went in search of those riders who made it through the most formidable of races, who finished when the television cameras had long since stopped rolling. Ilaria Sanguinetti lined up for the much-anticipated inaugural Paris-Roubaix Femme back in 2021, riding at the time for Italian continental outfit Valcar, alongside Elisa Balsamo.
We were, you know, a little but big team, you know. We were like a family, so it was like a Christmas for everyone. We are super lucky to do this race. When we were at the team presentation, we were the last team to be presented because, yes, of course, with the number one, with the rainbow jersey, everyone was cheering for us. The little team, but with the most important jersey.
By the time Eléonède King was preparing to take on the race in 2022, expectations for her L'Ecole Wahoo team were already high after their strong showing in the first edition.
It's quite a big goal every year for the team. And the year previously, the girls had done really well. I think they had two in the top 10 or something in that really wet edition. So, yeah, we did actually loads of work doing all the tyre pressures. Like, basically, our mechanic had thought of everything that could go wrong. Yeah, like, I'd reconned it, I think, 5 or 6 times. So I knew basically every cobble on that whole course and, like, renamed every cobble sector after a teammate. But I'd remember stuff that had happened in the recon. Like, one of my teammates, she's really experienced in like the cobble classics, so I did a lot of recons, just me and her, so I'd have like a Mayo section where I knew that's where Mayo liked to always attack me on recons.
For Seneca Narvan, the race was in her DNA. Her dad, Savas, won Paris-Roubaix back before she was born.
It's a special race. I think like my dad won it like in 2001. So it's like, I don't want to DNF, you know. The race has something, I think, to a lot of other girls as well. It's just like, it's just a special race, I think. It's, everyone wants to ride it.
Did your dad tell you anything before you started the race?
Yeah, just to be in the front, you know, like to be good in Roubaix, you have to be in like the top five the whole race. Otherwise, yeah, sorry for my language, you're otherwise.
For me, it was like a dream because, you know, you see always the race of the men when you are young and you say, maybe one day I can do this race. And then when you are there in the start line, you say, okay, I'm here. Every cobbles was like hell, really, because crash, puncture was crazy. Also the girls, every girl that was in the bunch, I think was super excited to do this race. So everyone was super energy, but was also crazy because you cannot do the same things that you can do with the dry condition.
Yeah, we actually woke up and it was unseasonably warm. At the start line, everyone wanted to be at the front, which is always the case in the classics, but it was even more, you could tell that even the big teams like Trek, who normally rock up to the start line 2 minutes before, you know, and you know they're going to be at the front at the end of the neutral, even they were like right at the front, like before we'd even started. So yeah, you start with a small lap of Dinant, and it's quite possibly the most dangerous 20k I've ever ridden. Like, it's just chaos because everyone's been told in their ear, oh, you have to be in the top 10. And obviously, if 140 people try to fit 10, the laps doesn't really work out.
Whether hot and dusty, as in Elined and Senna's 2022 race, or tipping it down with rain, like in Ilaria's 2021 edition, crashes in Paris-Roubaix are inevitable, even before the cobbles begin.
Yeah, I knew it was going to be a hard race, and of course, you hope you get a good result or something, but I crashed pretty early in the race. I was still like, lost like in the first 15k or something. And someone in front of me, she like swerved like from left to right. I just couldn't go anywhere. So I got back to the peloton, but like I crashed on my coccyx. So I couldn't push any power. So I was just riding in the back all day, just hoping to actually not hoping to finish anymore. But they kept me in the race, so then... Yeah.
There were like three or four crashes on the lead into the first sector, and the first two I managed to avoid, and then the third one I came down in, got back up, tried to get going again, and then got caught behind the fourth crash. And straight away I was like, oh, I'm in quite a bit of pain, like I'd hit the ground pretty hard. There were so many people everywhere and bikes just everywhere. You just try and find your bike, try and find your teammates, and yeah, get going again. Yeah, and then I basically just never saw the race again because I was so far behind after these crashes and trying to get my bike, like trying to get the chain on. And obviously our mechanic, we'd had quite a few crashes, I can't remember how many, but yeah, I basically was just with my bike already out of the back of the convoy, like, oh, you know, you're on your first sector of cobbles and you think, oh, there's 17 of these to go and you already can't even see the cart.
Yeah, it's like... So first moment is quiet, and then sometimes people are screaming, and then suddenly there's a crash, you hear all the bikes falling, and then people scream, and you hear everyone going in the radio, like, crash, crash, like, I'm safe, you know? It's kind of crazy.
Then was really a bad day, because it was raining, and, you know, some bad luck, there was a lot of crash. I remember about the crash of Guazzini. Then she stopped because she broke something in the feet. Sometimes you see that your teammates are really struggling. So I stopped with her. It was raining full gas and I waited for her. Really was super cold. She's a really nice girl. So we were really a family. So it's like your sister when you have some trouble, you know.
After crashes, injuries, or coming to the aid of stricken teammates, our three intrepid riders pushed on to the velodrome.
It was painful, but it was still like you still want to finish the race, you know? So it was kind of double. So, like, on one side, you're like, oh, I just want to quit, you know? But on the other side, it's like, but it's still Roubaix, you know? You just want to finish it.
You're always told in Roubaix, you just ride. Like, you never know what's going to happen. You just ride. You never stop riding. So I guess a bit of naivety and a bit of just that tiny bit of hope that at some point I might see someone again or something. And then second of all, which is probably the bigger reason, is Roubaix is a point to point. If you want to reach the cars, you kind of have to ride to the finish line.
I was completely alone. Completely alone. I remember there was a motorbike with me the whole time. Sometimes I was like thinking, no, now I have to stop because what I'm doing here. But then I say, I'm in the race, I'm in Paris-Roubaix.
Every cobble sector, my wrist that I'd crashed on was like shaking. I could like basically feel it shaking in my wrist. But I was like, this is the only way I get to the finish. So I was just holding the handlebars with one hand and my right wrist was just like kind of leaning over the top. I remember on Carrefour d'Arb, there was still loads of fans and there's one corner where they always have a Welsh flag. When I got there, I was pretty happy to see whoever owns that Welsh flag was still there. And it was so warm as well. And obviously the team cars have gone and everything. So you've not got any drinks and all. I got a Coke Zero off a fan and half of me was very grateful for it. But the other half of me was like, this has absolutely no carbs in.
As it says on the building overlooking the velodrome, the hell of the north leads to paradise, even if that paradise is just a relief that it's over.
It was actually crazy. Like, I didn't expect, like, I think all the people were still on the side when I came. I don't know how far behind I was, but I was riding on the cobbles and they were all cheering, but I didn't like it because I was pretty ashamed. I was like, I shouldn't be riding here, you know, like in the back. So I didn't really like it. I was like, nah, you shouldn't have to wait. I still remember it, like coming on the velodrome and like all the cheering and stuff. But I didn't really enjoy it because I was just like, I was like, oh, get me out of here, you know. Like after the finish, the team was standing there and then I just started crying. I remember. So it was a hectic day.
I was 19. To ride to Roubaix at 19, if we were males, like would be a story in itself kind of thing. I was pretty overwhelmed with emotion, to be honest, because the whole race I had the screen up on my thing just telling me how far to go, like not even directions or anything, just ticking down how far to go. Like, I don't really get that emotional about stuff like that, but I literally crossed the finish line and I just burst into tears because I was just, I think the pain and everything, I'm thinking I'm never going to make it and like being dehydrated, like it just all came over me quite a bit.
I know already that I was out of time, but you know, only to come inside of the velodrome in Roubaix, the people was cheering also for me also when I was like 20 or more minutes behind the first one. Yeah, when you drop, you're not always super happy, but so when you drop in a race like this, you say, yeah, you feel bad, but you say, I have to feel in myself proud to be here. So I want to honor the race and going to the finish.
Sanguinetti now rides for Lidl Trek, a team that can boast two of the three previous champions. Meanwhile, Carnarvon called time on her career last year, but the race still holds a special place in her heart.
Well, I'm really happy I did the race. Like, it's still something you can say, like, yeah, I did Roubaix, you know?
While for King, she hopes, tentatively at least, to ride those cobbles again.
I love riding those cobbles. Growing up, Roubaix was one of the highlights of the year to watch. It's definitely unfinished business, but yeah, I'm also a little bit scared because the carnage, I can't even describe the carnage.
And as for Sanguinetti, now a three-time veteran of the race, Paris-Roubaix has served her at least one big lesson.
I'm not using the gloves, never. I did the recon without the gloves. I remember that I finished the first sector and I had already some problem at the end. And I say, maybe I have to use the gloves. And now it's always the only race that I use the gloves.
Well, so much drama, isn't there, at the back of the race? We never talk about it, we never see it. But it's almost like there's more chaos, more crazy things going on at the back of the race than there is at the front. And so nice to hear different perspectives of how riders cope with that. You know, they're all professional athletes or semi-professional athletes, some of them, but you know, they cope with it in such a different way, Becca. To hear, you know, Senna Carnarvon saying she felt ashamed was so sad. And to hear Elle King be like, well, it's just, you know, still getting kilometres in, isn't it? Even though my wrist is, like, fractured. And
I know. I'm not laughing at her misfortune there, just, like, the different approaches. But, yeah, I think, firstly, the angle of that feature is absolutely brilliant, because when we see often the end of the race on the TV cameras, we miss so much. And I think we've said before, you look at a list of results and you do not know the story behind what's happened before the cameras start rolling, do you? And that's why I love that you've delved into this. It's brilliant. And I think, yeah, the biggest thing for me is two very contrasting mindsets there. Someone saying, you know, I'm at bloody Roubaix, this is absolutely amazing, and I'm just gonna, even though I've had such bad fortune and I'm behind, you know, the race convoy now, in fact the entirety of the race, but I'm going to finish it. And I think that's incredible. And that's actually a mindset I wish I had more, just generally transcending sport in life, is to be like, you know what, I'm just going to appreciate this. It hasn't gone to plan. It's you know, it's not necessarily going how I wanted it to go. But let's just embrace that, you know?
Elle King was actually showing me, she is kind of, you know, getting ready for this year. And Denny, as you'll know, the British Continental, of course, that she won the British Paralympic, as they sometimes call it, just as the last of the weekend. And she showed me all these horrible blisters that she got on her thumbs from doing the recons for this year, and obviously for winning a, you know, a big victory for her as well.
Yeah, she won the Cycle Classic, which is Britain's answer to Paris-Roubaix. It's not a UCI race, but it's a really important race on the British women's calendar. And Abby Smith has been a past winner, Josie Nelson. So some riders that have gone on to be pros have won that race in the past. And it's got a lot of kind of off-road sectors, mainly on farm tracks. So it's a little bit different. But yeah, it was a very mud-filled edition. So there's some brilliant images of Elle covered in mud, but, you know, smiling and so happy to have won. It's, it was a great story for her.
I know, and so, you know, so excited to wonder what she, you know, might accomplish. Obviously, it's totally, the field is totally different at these kind of big classics that that are coming up. The teams are so, you know, much bigger that she's going up against as well. But so many classics to look forward to. Obviously, we've got Genève-Wevelgem is going to be first, and then we've got Tour of Flanders and then Paris-Roubaix. Becca, what are you looking out for? What are you looking forward to?
All of it. I was just like doing the intro there. I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait. I was so excited. I was actually just thinking, you know, when you look at how brutal Roubaix is, I remember, and you were there at this time as well, interviewing Lizzie Dyknan on the back of her victory there, obviously the inaugural edition. It was just such a big time, wasn't it? For her, for the sport, for all of us enjoying that. But I remember interviewing her 2 days later or something, a very quick turnaround to the women's tour, and just seeing her hands. And I know we're like, it's brutal blisters and cobbles, but actually seeing how destroyed, like physically and visibly, all the riders were, and their hands were just hanging off, and they've got like plasters and bandages, just making sure they can actually hold the bars for the next race. And I think just seeing that firsthand, I was like, oh my goodness, this is just how hard that race is. And so I think that's sort of taken me back to thinking, I mean, it's not easy at the front or the back, but certainly staying out of that trouble at the front is so key for all of these races. And I think for me, I get so excited, and I know it's a cliche when we talk about unpredictability, but that terrain does make it unpredictable, and we can sit, and I'm sure we will, do our speculations and our predictions. But I mean, Alison Jackson proved you just don't know who's going to seize the day, and that's what I love about these Scots all season.
No, we've had some, I mean, obviously we've only had three editions of Paris-Roubaix, which is crazy. Obviously it's so historic in the men's field, but we've had three fantastic editions. Is that your favourite, Denny, or are you going to say Genève-Wevelgem all the way? Or
I'm not sure I have a favourite race, because
you like all of them.
I like all of them. No, I mean, I think, well, it is a very, very special race, and I just enjoy the diversity of cycling. That's why I love cycling. It's just such a crazy, diverse, unusual sport, and so many different angles to dive into, and that's why I think I love those stories you unearthed about the riders coming last, because they're stories you don't get to hear, or you don't get to see on the TV, and you don't get to see people's riders' hands on the TV. But I love unearthing those stories, the kind of stories behind what happens when you watch it on TV. You may not even see it if you're standing by the roadside, but I think that's the kind of mystique of cycling. That's why cycling became so popular. You know, when they covered cycling, races were set up by newspapers because the written word told so much and evoked so much in people's minds, and I think it still does with those stories. That can't be captured by the TV cameras.
They are also things that you would never ever come up with as a sport in this day and age. There's no way that coming up with Paris-Roubaix, people wouldn't come up with it. It's absolutely ludicrous. My favourite, seeing as you're all sitting on the fence and refusing to say it, my favourite race is the Ronde van Vlaanderen, Tour of Flanders, which is a maybe a bit controversial because everyone always says Paris-Roubaix, but for me it's a much more tactical race. So I think Paris-Roubaix, I know it's very unpredictable, there's crashes, there's punches, it's just it's total chaos, but for me there's something that I appreciate about the Tour of Flanders. It's super hard. You've got things like the Koppenberg, it's like 20-25% in its gradient, and then these huge cobbles to boot, but there's a bit more of a team game going on there. I think in Paris-Roubaix there is a bit of team tactics, but it really has to be, you just have to be the strongest, really. But I think in Tour of Flanders, it opens up a few more opportunities because you've got this kind of flat, uncobbled running right at the end. So you have to get the right riders in the right place. You have to work out when you're going to attack and when you're going to save your energy. So that would be my vote.
And going Roubaix, obviously, that if I have to pick one. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, we did. Any predictions for the cobbled classic? I'm going to push you guys because you're sitting on the fence here. I can see on your fence.
Now.
I'm trying to call you.
Well,
call
I'm
you guys.
Going to call Lionel and tell him that you're asking us to speculate, which is out of order.
No, on the podcast, though, we say we don't speculate, but we always do. But there's some obvious predictions. I mean, obviously, we're going to see Lotte Kopecky is going to be going. I mean, looking at her stats this season, we obviously spoken a lot about Lotte Kopecky already, but, the fact that she's been top two in five, she's done like eight race days. She's been top two in five of those days, plus winning the overall GC at UN Tour. I mean, and being in Belgium and, Paris-Roubaix is almost like an adopted Belgian classic because the Belgians have always historically on the men's side done so well there. You know, that's the whole hopes of a nation are on her shoulders there.
Yeah, I mean, she is, it has to be said, I mean, she is the outright favourite for Flanders. And we know from what we've seen early season that her climbing form is out of this world. I mean, I don't know if you saw Nokere Korsa, but there was an acceleration on the final climb that Kopecky did, and she just blew the rest of the field away.
Well,
with
she
that
was actually
in
Nokere Korsa. They were actually, there was a break ahead, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And then she did an acceleration on the climb that just, wiped this breakaway out, pushed them basically off the side of the road, went straight past, straight over the top. And then, Lotte Kopecky made her own little elite breakaway there. And then, they were a four, Lotte Kopecky, Lorena Wiebes, Lily Williams and Arlena Sierra. They made a little group of four. And then next cobble section in Nokere Korsa. And then Lotte Kopecky, without even looking like she's putting any energy in, she just rode away again, soloed away.
I mean, one thing I would say about Kopecky, though, is that she has now lost two sprints this year. So she lost out to Balsamo at Trofeo Binder, and of course she lost out to Marianne Vos in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. So I wonder whether that will make her a little bit nervous about bringing anybody to the line in some of these upcoming races. You know, in Flanders, will she... I think before she might have backed herself to win a sprint at the end of a race like that, but that might just change her mindset a bit. She might think, I need to lose these rivals, these riders, before we get to the line now. So it'll be interesting to see whether that changes the way she approaches things.
I think that's a really interesting point, actually, because I feel like the narrative towards the end of last season was just her versatility you can't get away from it, can you? But she was winning on the track. She was absolutely storming up the Tour de Tourmalet. She was winning a bunch of sprints. And you're just like, this really is pretty much unheard of what she is doing. But then I've read a lot about how over the winter she has been working on, she's lost a couple of kilograms, hasn't she? But she said she's lost absolutely no power. So she's just massively increased her power to weight ratio. And we can see that in her climbing weight. It's got even better since seeing what she did at the Tour de France Femme Mavic Zwift last year. But is that going to, in reality, come down to the sprint?
Does that mean that she's lost a bit in the sprint by getting
it's
some
a
of the
mindset
climbs?
Thing as well, isn't it? Because we were talking about mindset earlier, but she'll just have that niggling doubt. Maybe she seems so confident normally in a racecraft and how to play things, but I think sometimes confidence is really important as well about how you're going to approach it, and split seconds hesitations can make a big difference in a race like that.
But we did touch on it before. These races are unpredictable, and we did see a huge breakthrough really for Alison Jackson win Paris-Roubaix, totally unexpected, coming from a small break of riders there. None of them, being top contenders. None of them none of those riders being people that are on the potential winners list at the start of the race. So, we can get such unpredictability. Alison Jackson, she is now at EF Education Cannondale, and they kind of secretly, quietly, having a really good season. They're obviously a new team. They have a very similar name to the team from last year, an EF team from last year, but they are actually totally new license, new team. They have retained some of those riders, Alison Jackson being one of them. But a new team, a new setup, and a continental team, not actually a World Tour team.
Yeah, I mean, they're a continental team, but with a World Tour mindset. And Ezra Tromp, the manager of the team, has said that that's the way, well, that's their ambition, to move to the World Tour, whether that's through a team kind of dropping out of the World Tour or through the next relegation promotion battle, which will happen at the end of 2025. So they've done a brilliant job, as you say, under the radar so far, accumulating points. Of course, promotion will all be down to the amount of points you score from UCI racing. So they're currently 13th in the rankings, the highest placed continental team so far. And they've won 8 races this year, which is more races than any other team apart from SD Works Pro Time. Okay, they're not huge races, but nonetheless, you could put that just down to kind of smart planning, accumulating points, targeting races that they can rack up those points in, because they know come the end of 2025, they need to have those points in the bag to get promoted. So they've played it really smart, but under the radar. And I guess in the shorter term, they'll be looking also to an invite for the Tour de France Femme, because normally I think the invitations for the wildcard teams are announced around kind of the Ardennes time. So probably won't be long now before we hear who's picked. So they're putting themselves in prime slot to be one of those wildcards.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't think we knew what to expect of them at the beginning of the year, because they were kind of signed a lot of North American riders, of course, and being an American team. And a lot of riders that you would think, their big riders are actually in their 30s or almost 30, a lot of experience, but perhaps riders that other teams, chose not to sign. I don't know if that sounds too harsh, but perhaps coming towards the end of their time as cyclists, and obviously with a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge to pass on. But that's clearly actually done them very well to have this kind of mix of experienced riders who have won a lot of races, like Corinne Lebecki, Lotta Hentala, and then mixing that with much younger riders that are still trying to find their feet in the pro peloton.
And Kristen Faulkner has been, I guess, their outstanding rider so far, and she won in Het Haggeland, of course, with that kind of amazingly long solo breakaway. But she's picked up 3 of their wins so far. And 6th in Strade Bianchi, of course. So I think the one thing you would say about them is that they haven't really hit the headlines in the biggest races, but that's, they're only a continental team, and I think it's fair to say they're still punching well above their weight so far.
Now, before we go, there is one thing that I've totally failed to mention, and that was the retirement of Laura Kenny. And obviously I have to ask you, Becca, as a track specialist, a bit about Obviously, we don't normally cover the track. And I think Laura Kelly, she did have a few years at like Wiggle Honda, which was years and years and years ago. I remember there was a few trackies that did that, wasn't it? Because Joe Rousell kind of was with her and Laura Kelly. But yeah, Britain's, we went through this so many times, Britain's most successful female Olympian choosing to retire in Olympic year. But what a phenomenal career she's had. And I can't believe we, you know, I totally failed to mention her in our last episode about motherhood, when she's got two children and carried on racing, carried on winning gold medals.
Yeah. It's just incredible what she's achieved. And I've been doing a little bit of press throughout the week after she made her announcement, and it just makes you go back and relive a lot of her accolades. And I think I was saying it, she's 31, but she's had that longevity because she started, right? She started turning heads genuinely as an under 10 rider, and I'm old enough to remember this now, and I keep getting asked, so did you race together, what was it like training together? And I, not only was I not anywhere near the stratosphere of Dame Laura Kenny, but I'm quite significantly older, so we didn't have that overlap. However, I remember when Laura came down to Herne Hill Velodrome, which was my local London track where I was racing track league and things like that at the time, and you know, there wasn't a huge amount of opportunity for young girls to race together at that point, and she was just going in with, like, you know, E12A men, basically just very quick elite fields of men. And I remember watching her way before she was on the track program as a youngster. I remember watching her navigate her way through a men's devil, which we all know now as an elimination race, which has been in the Olympics in the Omnium. But she would find a gap where there wasn't a gap, but she did it safely. She did it so well, so, so well. And I remember just looking up one Wednesday night at track league and thinking, she's in the final three here. And she was just still such a young rider. And that for me was, you know, she's not just quick. She's just so tactically aware at this age, and she's got a huge future. And then of course the rest was history. But, you know, to go through three Olympic cycles and not just be selected, and not just go to the home games in London 2012, but win and have five gold medals and have come back from childbirth. I just think she's phenomenal, honestly.
Is. That's why I think they couldn't, you know, finish the podcast without giving her a mention. And, you know, also I thought it was very refreshing to hear her say, oh, I'm retiring. I want to just spend more time with my family. You know, it just wasn't, you know, making me happy anymore. Instead of, you know, people who kind of retire when they're like, oh, I just, you know, couldn't win anymore. So I just, you know, threw my toys out the pram. So kind of refreshing to be like, you know, I've come to my end of my time doing it. I've had a great time and I just wasn't loving it anymore, and that was my decision to leave. But what a legacy she leaves behind. But yes, well, we actually, I should have mentioned a bit earlier, we do actually have, you'll be hearing a bit more from us in the coming month, because we've got a few Arrives episodes, which are kind of our, I don't want to say hot takes. I think Lionel would not approve about me using the term hot takes for a podcast, but that's kind of our reaction episodes, where we're just after watching a race. So just after watching the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, we'll be kind of giving our perspective on those women's races. This year, we're really grateful to say that Arrive has been made possible by Bicycle, which is Europe's marketplace for used bikes. So thank you to them for supporting us in making these Arrive episodes. So you'll be hearing a little bit more from us before the next time when we come together, which will be after the Cobbled Classics, when we'll see all of these forced speculations that were very sort of, no one really putting their head above the parapet, can I just
SUS
say?
I think Pro Time are going to do really well.
but not at Zapana.
No, not that. Well, thank you very much, Becca. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been absolutely great to be here.
And thank you very much, Denny.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks, Becca.
Bye.
Becca.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.